Greg Berg. Let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. Minor League Baseball, the Kenosha Kingfish beat the Kalamazoo Growlers 3-2 last night. Kingfish and the Growlers play again tonight in Kalamazoo. Major League Ball, the All-Star Game, the American League beat the National League 2-1 in 10 innings. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Wednesday, July 12th. Flash flood watch till 10 a.m. Cloudy, hot, and humid. More rain, possibly heavy thunderstorms, likely this morning. High of 89. Heat index near 98 in the afternoon. And then more rain tonight, 60% chance. Tonight's low 70. The heat index tonight near 95. Going to be pretty muggy. Right now, rain rolling through the area and another storm system about an hour behind it, so we'll have more heavy rain, likely closer to 10 o'clock. It is 70 degrees right now. 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, a look at one of the most important conservative voices of the last half century, William F. Buckley. In part two, in a replay out of the morning show archives, one of the best books ever written about being a policeman, Blue Blood by Edward Conlin. Stay with us. We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show exploring the considerable legacy of William F. Buckley, Jr., among the most influential of all American conservatives. He was active in a lot of different spheres, and one aspect of his life and career which is perhaps not fully and properly appreciated is the way in which he was very influential, in a sense, behind closed doors, with a series of American presidents. And so, despite the fact that most Americans think of William F. Buckley Jr. Very much in the public sphere and in the large, deep swath he left as such an effective communicator on paper and on camera, it is some of this work that he did in a sense, quietly as an advisor, which is also a very important aspect of his significance. That is explored in a really interesting new book called A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Jr. And the author is Alvin Felsenberg, who was might be familiar to you particularly as the principal spokesman for the 9/11 Commission, served two different U.S. presidents, teaches in the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication, and also the author of The Leaders We Deserved and A Few We Didn't. Again, in this newest book, A Man and His Presidents, he explores the life and legacy of William F. Buckley, Jr. This is published by Yale University Press. Alvin Felsenberg, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, I'm honored to be with you today.
One of the things you say in the preface is that you knew William F. Buckley, Jr., and yet you really are cautious to not mischaracterize the nature of your connection or just how deep a friendship you had, or even if it was a friendship at all. Explain to our listeners just exactly what your connection was with him.
Well, I would call it an active acquaintanceship. I began as a fan. I never worked for Buckley. I never worked for National Review. I wasn't part of his inner circle. We weren't social friends. But he burst into our consciousness, at least mine, when he ran for mayor of New York. I'd never seen a more effervescent and refreshing personality appear. And, of course, he was running what he called the paradigmatic campaign against the conventional Republican and Democratic parties in New York City. He was very nonchalant. He answered questions with his real opinion. He was exceptionally witty. His first comment was to say that he would demand a recount. If he had any chance, he would be elected mayor. And you got to say, who is this fella? And then the campaign ended, and before long, he was on firing line debating the likes of Arthur Schlesinger and Norman Thomas and some of the great intellectuals of the period. And Norman Thomas, by the way, a six-time presidential candidate of the Socialist Party ticket. Arthur Schlesinger, a historian and advisor to President Kennedy. So I started writing a mail. I started writing to him, I guess, as any teenager might, a role model. To my delight, he would answer them. He'd answer questions I would have about something he had in the column and started asking if I could have a meeting, and I did have a meeting. He graciously welcomed me to the National Review as he and his editors were putting the paper to bed, the magazine to bed every 2 weeks. And we kept in touch. But again, I won't say that I was an intimate of his. This is not an overly fawning biography. It's a fair biography. I don't back away from criticizing him where I think he deserved it. And of course, praising him where I think it was warranted.
Right.
So that's the extent of our relationship.
How in step were you with each other philosophically? That is, in the way that you saw the world and the kind of conservatism that you each embraced.
He had an impact on me. There's no question on it. I grew up in a Democratic family. Although my family would begin to watch firing line along with me, and some of them did change their opinions on a few things, which is what he wanted. He wanted Republicans and Democrats to engage and have their values questioned. So as I was growing up and high school turned into college, again, I was not a movement conservative as we define it now, but I did read the magazine. I did identify more at those days with Republican than Democratic. By the time Ronald Reagan was coming along, we all voted for him. Very proud to have cast that vote. But I am a historian first and a political scientist first. I was an academic for many years. I did go in and out of public service. I was happy of my time in government. He had a tremendous influence on me because he led me to challenge my ideas, and he led me to defend my ideas. He used to say that conservatives have a harder go than liberal students because liberals find affirmation in the mainstream media. Obviously, most of the editorial coverage of the New York Times, the Washington Post, in those days only three networks. But conservatives have to justify everything they believe almost every waking hour if they are in the public sector, the public sphere. They want to make a contribution to the policy debate. I think he's right about that.
Explain.
I think he was right about that.
Explain the void which William F. Buckley Jr. filled when he came to the scene when it comes to the conservative movement in this country. He was a voice like none that had been heard before, or heard at least in recent memory. Maybe what I'm really asking is, what was the state of affairs with American conservatives, and what sort of voice did they have before William F. Buckley Jr. came along?
Well, there were conservatives, but they did not all agree on all issues. It was hardly a movement. They coalesced on certain things that came up, but they didn't quite like each other very much or form much of a presence. You had, for instance, the National Association of Manufacturers, which Buckley considered a nice group of decent, stodgy people, pretty much paraphrasing. They wanted low taxes. They may also have wanted tax breaks for certain industries. They may not have been very pro-labor unions. You had Midwestern isolationists like Robert Taft, who's famous for the Taft-Hartley law that constrained the power of labor unions. And you Southern Democrats that were right to work and anti-union in their own states. Occasionally they would vote the same way in Congress and lobby on the same side. But you get to another issue. You had those same Southerners with Southern segregationists. And Robert Taft was a great champion of civil rights. So what did they have to agree on? It was not much of a movement. And I would say before Buckley came along, there weren't many conservatives writing and speaking. That was the great void. The historians look back on that period. I mean, Richard Hofstadter, one of many, a line of many, began to call this the period of the great consensus, the great liberal consensus. John Kennedy gave a speech at Yale in 1962 where he said most of the ideological problems have been solved. The only difference between Republicans and Democrats are how they wanted to apply technology to problems that could be analytically assessed and resolved quantitatively. There was a liberal scholar, named a little intellectual named Daniel Bell, who wrote a book called The End of Ideology. So you had this literary critic, Lionel Trilling, who said there were really no conservative ideas in circulation. All the major thoughts were liberal. There were occasional cranks on the right. There were occasional complaints on the right. It wasn't much of a movement. That's kind of correct. When you turn on the television now, you see debates between analysts. There were always analysts on these shows. Sometimes analysts of two liberals and one conservative. Rarely two conservatives and one liberal. But you do see conservatives. You have conservative magazines. Networks that might identify with the conservative point of view. There was none of that when Buckley began. And all through the 50s and most of the 60s, he was it. You know, we all may have colleagues we've admired in our professional work who pull above their own weight, shall we say, or punch above their weight. He was called in as a counter to almost every liberal of the day. He would debate Mellon, there was no one else to call. He would debate Galbraith, no one else to call. Schlesinger, no one else to call. Gore Vidal, no one else to call. Well, he was in some ways pulling the weight of nine people for a very long time. It took until, I guess, the 70s. Buckley started his column in 61, started the magazine in 55. It took till the 70s, mid-70s, for George Will to come along and be granted a syndicated column, which Buckley did pick up 15 or so years earlier. Then it took another 10 years for other things to happen. Now there's a plethora of them. Very hard for my students to recognize the time when they're absolutely done on radio and television. Buckley was very aware of that. First of all, he was aware of his charisma, which he used as a marketing tool. He was aware of his allure and his appeal to young people that love to be inspired and are very idealistic. He appeared at 70 campuses a year in his heyday. He was prepared to lose every debate on policy when people applauded at the end and who won this debate on capital punishment or on recognizing Red China or on Vietnam or you name it. But when it was over, everybody wanted to have, he was the one everybody wanted to have a drink with. And in those settings, he did his best work, I would say.
Right. In fact, in the very first paragraph of your book, you talk about how one of the words most often associated with William F. Buckley Jr. was fun. And, of course, that's also something that, you know, maybe a young person who firsthand knew nothing about Mr. Buckley in his heyday, they might glance at a picture of him and see someone who, at a glance, looks pretty serious, and then when he speaks is quite serious. But there was this sense of fun and wit about him. How did that serve him, however, behind closed doors as he advised presidents? I mean, did that figure in those relationships?
Less so, unless he was trying to cheer up one of the Reagans when they were down or make a witty observation about a colleague. For instance, he once recommended Walter Cronkite to the Century Club of New York City. When you join a club of that prestige, you have to get two members to write for you. And he wrote, Walter Cronkite is great company. He's amazingly, especially astute on current affairs. Now, this is written to the board of a major club in New York City. This is not the kind of letters I write for students who want to go to law school or anything like that. But the wit was amazing. He had the wit quite young. Now, wit is not something we identify with many conservatives to begin with. And Goldwater had a bit of it. Not as biting as Bill's. And Reagan had a tad of it. Actually, a lot of it, but not like Buckley's. Buckley's was spontaneous. They would come to him as he was debating. He admired wit. He admired use of language. He lamented that when he was coming aboard, all the witty statesmen that we had today were on the liberal side. He studied Adlai Stevenson's speeches. He studied FDR's speeches. He was somewhat entranced with Kennedy's charm, but not with his politics. And he began to say, how come we don't have any of these? You know, we have what I said earlier. We have these wonderful, well-meaning, grandfatherly men in silver wire eyeglass frames, maybe 50 pounds overweight, exceptionally stodgy, and not very interesting. Now, here was a guy that he was a competitive skier. He was a sailor. He was an aviator. He explored some of the desolate parts of our planet. I went to the Arctic, went to both poles several times. This is not exactly, you know, what I described with all due respect to the National Association of Manufacturers, what you saw in 1950 when you thought of conservatives. And young people just rallied to him. Now, the other thing was he got the column on a lark because, once again, a syndicator was watching him debate some of the people I mentioned earlier. And he and Gar Vidal were both invited, that name keeps coming up, to write something for a newspaper on the future of the country and where the country was going ideologically. Vidal made the case I just made, that, you know, if there is a conservative around, it's JFK because he worships technology, not ideology, and he's willing to rise above the ideological debates of the socialists and the free marketeers of the 1930s and 40s, and therefore everything that's been solved. Buckley said, you know, hey, young people are rebellious. It was the young socialists that began to feed the armies of the New Deal in the early days. It was young Walter Lippmann. It was young Jack London, the novelist. It was John Reed. Now, what is this Harvard kid doing buried in Red Square? Well, he thought that he could make the world better, and he was misguided, but he was pulled in by Lenin and Trotsky's charisma. Young people want to believe something bigger than themselves. I'm going to do the same thing for conservatism. He studied them very carefully, and his answer was, I'm going to use young people's capacity to rebel to build a conservative movement. Now, what's very interesting is most of the histories of the 1960s deal with the student left, the anti-war movement, the nascent environmental movement, and other things that came after that, women's movement. And Buckley said, well, we're going to do the same thing on the other side. So the Sharon Statement, which begins the Young Americans for Freedom, at a gathering of conservatives who felt the Republicans were not strident enough in their free market politics and anti-communism, create the young Americans for Freedom. Yeah. Sharon's statement is signed about a month before the SDS statement that Tom Hayden and some others drafted. The Goldwater campaign. It was not a very successful campaign, as we all know, but it was fueled by young people. It was fueled on the college campuses. One of the reasons Goldwater ran, I mean, he knew he had no chance to win, particularly after Kennedy was assassinated. He knew that the country would not have that many presidents in a very, very short time. I mean, you had Eisenhower giving way to Kennedy, Kennedy giving way to Johnson over 3 or 4 years. He knew he had no chance. But he said he dared not break the hearts of his supporters. The youth from Goldwater started in 1960, and they had worked the business for 4 years. He felt obligated to run. Buckley tapped into that. Young people like wit, they like pithy, they like fun, they like the difference.
Right.
And most newspaper columnists don't show up on campus on a motorcycle and things like this. he was just extraordinary.
He truly was, and we really get a sense of all the ways in which he was such an extraordinary, charismatic figure. Your book, again, is called A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Jr., published by Yale University Press. Alvin Felsenberg, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your fascinating book.
I enjoyed it very, very much. Thank you.
Part two of today's morning show is coming up in just a moment here on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. Ahead of part two of today's morning show, we've received word that Petrifying Springs Park is closed all day today due to considerable flooding, and any planned activities in the park are canceled as well. The time is 8:31. We'll give you a full weather forecast at the top of the hour. Part two of today's program is from the archives of the morning show.
I am tremendously excited to be speaking today on The Morning Show with Edward Conlin, who is a detective with the New York City Police Department and the author of a magnificent book called Blue Blood, which details his experiences over the last few years as a member of the New York City Police Department, and not just his own participation, but that of other family members. His writing first appeared in a series of articles in the New Yorker magazine, and he continues his work on the New York Police Department, and we're very grateful that he can join us for a few minutes to talk about the experience of writing this marvelous and endlessly fascinating book. Edward Conlin, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about the experience for you to live what you call at one point something of a double life, of being an active police officer in New York City and at the same time writing on the side, and at least at first writing without the knowledge of at least most of your colleagues. How difficult was that for you?
It was interesting, but I think every cop has a double life of one kind or another, whether you're working 9 to 5 in the ghetto and going home to the suburbs, or whether your home life is troubled and your real family is on the job. A lot of cops have second jobs, and everybody feels that they're doing something a little wrong as a cop, because nobody is doing everything perfect. You're never signing in exactly on time, or keeping your memo book up, or your shoes shined, or your hair cut. So everybody feels like they're getting away with something a little bit, where they could get in trouble for something.
I like how you say at one point, all cops exist in a state of mild infraction.
Yep. There's always something they can get you for. we have a 600-page rule book, which covers everything from what time of year your shirt sleeves can be short and what time of year you can take the tire chains off the patrol cars. And then they say, you know, it's flexible, which means that they can bend the rules however they want. So there was a bit of a pull between, you know, the writing life and the cop life, especially because I was keeping it secret, so to speak. I wrote under another name just because I only had 2 years on the job when I did the first New Yorker piece called Cop Diary, and I didn't want people to wonder, to question my motives. I was relatively new, and also I didn't really want to speak for anybody other than myself. I mean, I was just learning the job and trying to explain what it was, what you do in a big city police department in a bad neighborhood. And cops, like anybody else, are sensitive to the idea of being watched or being scrutinized.
I want to talk for a moment about the fact that when you are a police officer, not just in New York City, but I suppose anywhere, you see certain things that you probably wish you hadn't seen, and to some extent you probably do things you later wish you hadn't done, and so on. And so you as a writer faced an interesting dilemma in how honestly to write about the good and the bad in the New York City Police Department. I think you've achieved a wonderful balance. But one of the things you say in your book is that the police often are punished for everything but serious wrongdoing. Civil service protections make prosecution for brutality or graft an elaborate and lengthy process, and the political will to achieve them was spasmodic at best. But patrolmen saw themselves as hostage to myriad regulations, and it's on those that so often a police officer would sometimes be rather arbitrarily tripped up.
Sure, that's more in the olden days than right now, where graft and corruption are fortunately pretty rare, as far as I can tell. I've been involved in thousands of arrests in over 9 years, and I only got one offer of a bribe, so hopefully that's a good indicator of the market. But in terms of the bureaucratic regulation of police world, especially with dealing with such a lively and crazy city, and the contrast between the kind of made-up, make-believe order of the patrol guide and the raw life of city streets is where this contradiction is.
You talk about the experience of going through the academy where you are trained to be a police officer. And I thought it was interesting. You talked about how that academy experience was in some ways, I think you say, a blend between a boot camp and kindergarten.
Oh, sure.
And at a couple other places, you talk about how police officers are expected to be investigators, social workers, bouncers, and soldiers, but often treated like errant schoolboys. What an odd mix, what an oddly mixed experience this has been for you and some of your colleagues in that respect.
Oh, yeah. They have lanes painted in the hallways. So you have to stay to one side or the other side and walking. You can only walk up the upstairs staircases and down the damn staircases. I don't think in kindergarten I had as many people telling me what to do.
Hmm. You say that new cops could be smelled like new paint. I mean, there was just something about a new cop that you really knew. And you said you were met with amusement or abuse, depending on who was looking at you. We were little players late for the game. And I especially like how you say we were like the equipment we carried, dangerously new. In what way is a new cop dangerously new?
Oh, a lot of ways. I mean, you're people aren't calling the police when they're having a good time. They're not calling the police 911 to say thank you. You're getting called to somebody's house because they've got a serious problem. And you're going to be the one who has to fix it, or at least tell them what they can do or not do and begin to show them a way for their life to get better. And that's a tremendous responsibility for anyone, let alone a 21 or 22-year-old kid who might have been flipping burgers 2 years ago.
Hmm. One of the things you describe is something that is so easy for the rest of us to take for granted, especially if all we know about police work is what we see on television or on the movie screen. You talk, for instance, about not only the difficulty of the gigantic amount of paperwork that is involved whenever you have arrested someone or have witnessed an accident or whatever, but then something as what we might think of as relatively simple as hearing a gunshot and trying to figure out where it's coming from. You said you would run after gunshots like kittens hunting a flashlight beam on the floor.
That's right.
And especially as a young cop, I imagine that had to be tremendously difficult and frustrating.
Oh, yeah, and that's when you were a young cop. We heard them all the time, and we looked around, and sometimes, somebody would find somebody on a rooftop or something. But generally, you were just brand new at this, and it was It was a life-death situation that you were walking into. And, the academy was good. It's excellent professional training. But as soon as you walk out on your own, you realize what a pretty, pretty daunting responsibility is.
Hmm. You say at one point the New York Police Department is less and less a fraternity, but it will remain a kind of ethnicity, because ethnicity is defined by language. I was surprised to see the attention that you gave to this. This is clearly something that is more significant than probably the rest of us as onlookers would ever imagine.
Oh, sure. Cop slang, I mean, I love hearing it. I mean, you got one under, two under, three under is how many you have under arrest, but for a transit cop, a man under is under a train. I like how people say EOT, which means end of tour, but you'll use that for a DOA as well. Say, this guy's gone end of tour. It's mopes and scales, and a collar can be a pinch, a collar being an arrest, of course. But the only real police word that sort of made it to the language as a whole is moonlighting. That had to do with obviously working a second job and working the night shift back in the old days.
Your first assignment was to be a PCO, a project community officer, a beat cop assigned to a particular housing project. And you clearly learned a whole lot during that experience. I thought one of the most interesting observations you make is you say, the neighborhood was one where children had to walk through three different brands of crack vials in the lobbies, and most people, young and old, could tell the sound of gunshots from fireworks or a car backfiring. But the genuine surprise was how wholesome and ordinary many lives were there. Life in the projects can be just like it is in suburbia, except that it takes place on busier streets and in smaller rooms, and sometimes it's even better. What a surprising thing for you to have observed, and a surprising thing for the rest of us to learn as well, that in the midst of decay and of violence and all that we hear about in these projects, there are also people at least trying to live out ordinary, wholesome, important lives.
Oh, absolutely, and that was the surprise. And most people, even in the worst neighborhoods, are living just like that. They're trying to work. They're working. They're trying to take care of the kids and do better for themselves. And that's why cops are so important, and especially in poorer neighborhoods and minority neighborhoods in the city. And when you only hear the bad things, you know, good news is no news. So only when something goes wrong do you really hear about it. So it was a surprise to me. Because I never really thought about cops. I didn't look for cops. I'm walking down the street. I was more likely to run from one when I was younger. But you realize how important seeing a cop is to a person who's trying to get by in a bad neighborhood. And, you know, it made me very happy to be there, because you saw that people were happy to see you. And it's basic things like getting to work, getting home, are challenges in bad neighborhoods that they're not for people in the rest of the country.
We're speaking with Edward Conlin. He is the author of Blue Blood, which chronicles his experience as a police officer with the New York City Police Department. You say at one point, good cops are method actors in that they make a controlled use of their emotions, from empathy or anger, depending on whether the scene to be played is a conflict with a crowd or persuading an emotionally disturbed person to go to a hospital. We wouldn't very quickly assume that this would be the heart and soul of so much of what a police officer does.
Oh, yeah. Talking is most of the game. I mean, some situations you're going to be able to change, and some you're not. I mean, you may be sitting with a woman whose husband's dead in the back bedroom. You're not going to make him, you're going to be there till the body goes, and nothing's going to change the fact that he's dead. But you're going to, how you talk to this person and carry yourself can make this situation, you won't be a part of the bad situation. It may be something that makes a little better. And absolutely, this is in terms of other, how do you talk to people? How do you deal with the crowd? How do you deal with the crazy person? How do you talk to a criminal, to whether you would just want them to calm down and stop screaming, or maybe you want to talk to them into cooperating, whether it's just making a statement or becoming an informant.
Right. You say what you say and how you say it comes into play far more often than anything you do with your stick or gun. And it can prevent the need for them. And if you talk a good game, you're halfway there.
Yeah.
Is that something that the academy adequately trains you for? Or is that something that is better learned, more easily or readily learned on the job?
It's a combination of both. I mean, I think they do a pretty good job at the academy. But you can only go so far in bringing somebody to a point where they can listen, where they can talk, and they can help guide a conversation and give the kind of respect and sympathy that can be very times hard to provide to someone, but can bring a situation down a notch.
Hmm.
So people aren't screaming or swinging.
We are in this book exposed again and again to the complexities and challenges which confront you and all of your colleagues. For instance, at one point you say, you may only have seconds to take stock, to make a nearly instantaneous appraisal of a jumble of allegations, injuries, insults, histories, and relationships between neighbors, brothers, lovers, ex-lovers, lovers again, with roots of enmity as tangled and deep as those between Balkan tribes. You say, no, I just need to know what happened today. Just sorting through all of that. What a tremendous challenge.
Oh, it's a tangle. It's a tangle. I'm amazed. You know, I work in a robbery squad now, and I have to prove that a crime was committed, and I have to prove who did it. I don't have to prove what the hell they were thinking, because I'm constantly surprised of what brings people to do these things. I locked up a cab driver the other day. Came in. He was a very cooperative victim. He had the perp in the back seat locked up. He said these two women tried to rob him at knife point. And we had one and collected the other, and over hours and hours and hours of talking with him. And the girls, who had plenty, who were plenty bad. They had 26 arrests between them, and including knife point robberies of a cab. But just talking and talking and talking, I realized he made the whole thing up. And he was just offended by these two ghetto girls, as he saw them, who were rude and disrespectful. So he locked them in the back seat and said they tried to rob him. I can't believe what brings people to the point where they do things like that. But you've got to have your ears open and your eyes open and to find out what fits and what doesn't fit and trying to get to the bottom of the story.
Hmm. You talk about the relationship between police officers, and it is a curious thing, isn't it, that in some ways there are very, very tight bonds, and yet in other ways these are not maybe as close of relationships as we might think them to be in terms of the amount of time you might spend together with each other socially outside of the workday. And you also talk about how amongst the police officers in the NYPD, there is an amazing diversity. At some point in the book, you talk about how if you wanted a definition of motley, just get a bunch of police officers together in one room
and tell them to show up in business attire. What's business attire? Are you a pimp or a ditch digger? It's a suit. It's amazing where people come from, which is part of the strength of the department, because probably have people who speak 80 different languages on the job. But it also it can be like have the troubles with New York City with the some frictions and some tribalism and but I think they do a reasonable job in cops thinking of themselves as cops.
Hmm. You have you talk in your book about your history of misdeeds as a young person, in particular an incident in which you and a friend actually broke the front window of a Greek diner.
That's
and
right.
You ended up being hauled in by the cops and
uh-huh.
so on, and revealed that only to your father only many days later.
Yes, I was less afraid of jail than my father at the time. and I figured it was better to spend the night behind bars than to deal with my father, which I knew I'd have to do, but even worse, we were going on a family vacation in the meantime. So I wasn't going to spend a week talking about my lack of character. I'd rather put it off to the last minute, which I did.
You sort of pose a question which is which had been posed to you by someone at the Academy, I think, which is if that could possibly have made you a better cop somehow, if having at least a touch of that in your past was somehow helpful.
Well, everybody should remember, there but for the grace of God go I. And, even though cops have to enforce the law and have to do it systematically and with fairness, I think the best cops usually have a little bit of trouble in their past that maybe gives them a little sympathy and understanding for people, and sometimes that gives you a little leg up on how to catch the bad guys.
You speak at great length about some of the very interesting work you did with the Street Narcotics Enforcement Unit. And one of the things that you especially appreciated about this was you said, for one thing, you only dealt with criminals. Just on the surface, that doesn't make a lot of sense to as we read those words. But in fact, for a relief for a cop in a strange way, that is a sort of blessed relief to only deal with criminals. Explain that.
After patrol, where you deal with everything from barking dogs to family fights to emotionally disturbed people to people will call you if the toilet overflowed and they'd expect you to mop the floor. I mean, you had serious crimes and not so serious crimes and lots of just everyday craziness. When moving to narcotics, it was a nice simplification. All I dealt with was crack and dope, the people who bought them and the people who sold them. It was kind of a refreshing change in its way.
Yeah, you say patrol was politics, but narcotics was pure technique. You especially talk about the technique of surveillance, which I think we tend to underestimate in terms of its difficulty. You say watching is not always easy, and there is a grueling dullness about surveillance, which is only one facet, I suppose, of what makes it very, very challenging.
That's right. In our area, we knew pretty much where the established corners were and who the established players were. We called the drug dealers players. So there was always usually somebody out on these corners, and the way we set up to do a set, as we called it. We'd have somebody in an observation post, or maybe two people in an observation post, and they'd have a radio and describe buyers to the people who were in the catch car, and they'd scoop them up. But being in that observation post, it was almost like a nature show, because you just had to study the corner, and you would see who's the guy who's standing there, who's standing with them, who are the lookouts. You'd watch how people would approach him. I mean, whether it be tentative, would they beeline to him? When they met the first guy, were they sent to the second guy? Did they have to check with the third guy to see if he's approved? And, you know, they might get 10 people at once. It might be an hour before people came back. I mean, it was like watching pins on a map sometimes. And there was a strange science to it. They would sometimes, when they sold to somebody, they would send a guy on a bike to follow that buyer a couple of blocks to see if we picked him up. They might send out a dummy buyer, somebody who looked like they bought drugs, to see if he'd be picked up. And obviously they wouldn't have drugs on him, but when we let him go, they'd get to run back to the corner and say, yep, they're watching us. So it was an interesting and much more detached kind of police work that I'd done before, and it was amazing to learn.
I have to say, one of the moments in the book that just made my heart kind of stop was in your beautiful and nuanced description of how you viewed drug addicts. You said there is something authentically tragic about addicts in the way the wreckage of their lives is both freely chosen and somehow fated. They are both casualties of a condition that is believed to have a genetic component and committed collaborators in their own downfall. They deserve pity always, and often they inspire contempt. That is a very nuanced way of looking at a figure in our society that we are so quick to dismiss.
It is tragic. They are tragic. Sometimes it seems they never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity, as said about somebody else. But it was heartbreaking, especially one informant that I got to like quite a bit, who had gone for years straight, and one slept 2 weeks later, he's living under a bridge, literally like a troll in a nursery story. And how I couldn't believe how heroin for him was more important than any other thing in his life. He was making more money than I was panhandling than I was as a cop. He would stand by the on the exit ramp to a highway with a sign. He made about $1 a minute during rush hour. And I realized, you know what, if you have a $100 a day habit, you have to get $100. I mean, you know what, that's a guy making $700 a week, and he lives in the dirt under a bridge, and everything in his life, everything is geared to a bag of dope. And what an awful thing, because he's He's tried to get out. He's also turned his back on trying for more of the time.
Hmm.
So it's exhausting and very, very saddening.
You say at one point the danger, at least in some kinds of police work, is not in corruption, the fear of corruption entering the picture, so much as corrosion. It's an interesting choice of terms. To what extent in your career as a police officer do you feel like you have begun to feel at least a little sense of that corrosion, whatever it is that you exactly mean by that? And how does a cop guard against that or work against that occurring?
It's very hard, and that's certainly the real danger I see in police work. I mean, I've made hundreds of arrests. I've been present for thousands of arrests. I've gotten one offer of a bribe, which I hopefully is a good indicator of what the market is there. But in terms of being worn out and worn down, suicide and divorce and alcoholism are real problems in the police department. And it burns you out and wears you out when the difficulties of dealing with what we deal with on the street is compounded by a department that sometimes seems as indifferent and irrational as the things we deal with. I mean, we're not allowed to have, for example, HBO in the precincts. We can't watch cable TV because we might see a naked woman on it. But in the meantime, we're going out and walking through crime scenes. So real dead bodies are what we deal with, but we're not allowed to see them on TV. You know,
wow.
We can't go out sick without calling first to get permission, but to even leave our house, we have to call in to ask permission to leave our house to go to the corner to get some medicine or something to eat and call when you return. So, you are treated like a kid in a lot of ways, but you're dealing with life as bad as it gets.
I was going to say, real life as real as it gets, certainly.
Yeah.
What is so intriguing about your book, Mr. Conlon, among many things, is that so much of your book is about the ordinary days of a police officer, which, of course, are not all that ordinary, and that even in the ordinary there is such fascinating detail to see. But then your book also tells us about moments of great tragedy, moments of incredible courage, and, of course, one of the most important passages in your book talks about the devastating effect on New York City of 9/11. Tell us the lasting ways in which life there and life for police officers has been changed by that terrible day in 2001.
Well, I was at work that morning. I was looking over a report for a commercial robbery the night before, a bodega stick-up, and I just heard the noise of a lot of shouts from the meal room where a lot of guys were having coffee, and I walked over and saw it on TV like everybody else did, and then the second plane hit. Then the sergeant said, "That's it, suit up, we're at war." And I had uncles who had a restaurant and a coffee shop and a bar in the World Trade Center. I've been going to that building since it opened. They were among the first tenants there. That's where we went out to eat when my family ate out. So it was unreal. And for a couple of days, they just put us in uniform and didn't know exactly what to do with us. And that was very frustrating because you'd watch on TV some interview with some guy who said, "Yeah, I just hopped in my truck and came down here to help out." And meanwhile, they were turning away cops in uniform. Pretty chaotic scene down there. When I did get down there, it was something obviously no one who was ever there will ever forget. Not only what it looked like, but what it smelled like, this sour, burning smell and the smoke and that beautiful piece of the facade that held up after the rest of the building went down. It looked like a crown. I did a lot of work in Fresh Kills in Staten Island. Fresh Kills was the name of a dump which is where they trucked 100 million tons of debris from the World Trade Center, and we sorted through it by hand looking for body parts. And that was a long, long winter. And it was just, again, unreal there. I mean, because it was this mountain of trash in Staten Island that looked out over the harbor. So you saw the Statue of Liberty, and you saw Lower Manhattan, and you saw the World Trade Center still burning. And we always got there at dawn or at dusk for these 12-hour tours. So we had these brilliant sunsets, the sunrises, and the smoke, and the sky, and the F-16s circling the Statue of Liberty. And we put on these Tyvek suits and goggles and masks and, you know, look like aliens that we spread out over the field to rake through the dirt for bones.
Edward Conlon and his book, one of the best ever written about the work of police officers, is called Blue Blood. Tomorrow on the morning show, Nicole Thompson will join us from